Thank you, Andy, Debbie, and Ian for putting this symposium together, and thank all of you also for coming here today on this last day. I really thought we would be having this symposium sooner or later. I just didn't realize it would be so soon. So what I decided to do today, rather than talk about a lot of data, although I think I am a little bit, is to give you a little bit of history of some of the ideas that Bob and I had the good fortune of working on together when I was a postdoc in the lab in the late 90s. And I want to use this opportunity to just illustrate some generalities of some of the things that he worked on and how they might apply to other systems elsewhere. And so given this brief time, I'm really not going to go into a lot of details, but just talk about some of the some of these general principles, perhaps, and really then how it inspired me in some of the work that I'm currently doing. Before I do move on today, I want to acknowledge my co-authors. And these include Jason Harmon, who helped me with some of the modeling that I'm going to talk about at the end, and of course to Bob, who I think in a lot of ways will always be a co-author on a lot of papers that I write. So let's see how this works. So Bob arrived in Maryland in the late 70s, and he pretty much just fell into the marsh, kind of like this. And before long, he started working on Proclesia plant hoppers. These are little delphacids that are obligate feeders, phloem feeders, on the dominant grass on the salt marshes Spartina. And during this time, there really was a raging debate in the literature as to what were the dominant forces that governed the fluctuations in the populations of herbivores. Was it bottom-up factors or things like resource quality, abundance of resources, plants? Was it phytochemistry? Or was it top-down factors, predators, parasites, or things acting from the top of the food chain onto the poor middle trophic levels that were kind of sandwiched in between them? And we've heard a lot of great talks today that kind of explain some of the theory behind this. And I think that Bob really made two principal observations when he walked out on the marsh. And I think these kind of set the tenor for a lot of the work that he did after that. And the first was that he recognized that populations of plant hoppers were spatially variable on the marsh. And in fact, the marsh itself was spatially variable, even though at first glance it looks like just a carpet of homogeneous Spartina. If you look carefully, you can see that here in the foreground, you have the same grass, Spartina, growing by the creek sides, is significantly taller, more lush than the grass in the background here. The grasses in the front is called the low marsh. This is typically on the lower part of the tidal elevation and is influenced by the tide twice daily at least. And whereas on the high marsh, the plants are short, they're stunted. Here's Debbie kind of digging around. You can see that the plants are actually quite small. So this was the first observation that Bob made. And he also noticed that plant hopper populations tended to outbreak in these areas here in the low marsh, and populations tended to be usually quite low on the low marsh. So populations were heterogeneous on these heterogeneous plants. One of the reasons for this, and actually Bob made two principal observations relating to this, was that plant hoppers were very sensitive to the nitrogen content or the quality of the plants across this the spatial gradient. This is actually data from an experiment that we actually did later where we fertilized plants to create or to mimic this plant quality variation. And then we looked at the response of the plant hoppers to that, and you see this very tight positive response to this variation in plant quality that that Bob hypothesized on the marsh. The other observation that Bob made was that that the creekside areas are actually affected very much by inundation and by scouring in the winters. And as a consequence, those habitats are very impermanent. They're ephemeral habitats, at least over over an yearly lifespan. And a related observation was that, in fact, the plant hoppers that inhabit these areas, there are two dominant species that inhabit that feed on the Spartina, the short-winged Proclesia dolus and the long-winged Proclesia marginata. And Bob reasoned that actually the evolution, that there was an adaptive significance of these two different morphs, one of which tends to be most dominant in those outbreak situations on the low marsh, and the other one tends to dominate the community on the high marsh. And Bob reasoned that the ephemerality of the resource was one of the reasons why the Highly dispersive, long-winged forms tended to be most common on the low marsh, and these more sedentary forms tended to be more common on the high marsh. And there was a whole body of work that emerged in the early 80s, up through the 90s, that really explored the consequences of this plant quality difference and this habitat ephemerality difference that occurred on the marsh, and how it interfaced and influenced the evolution of the life history characteristics of these plant hoppers. Oh, this is the pens up digression of the talk. This is the how well do you know Bob? Obviously, you all picked up the answer is B, yes. Although he was always found with a Bacardi in his room at these meetings, it was really Flor de Caña was his favorite rum. Anyway, I will be keeping track. Your scorecards will be collected at the end of the talk. Anyway, so these were two principal observations that Bob made on the marsh. But Bob was nothing if not observant, and we've heard at least several times about his keen sense of natural history and observation. And he noticed that in addition to differences in plant quality that varied along this elevational gradient from the low marsh to the high marsh, there was also a variation in natural enemies. And the natural enemies seemed to vary where they tended to be less common on the low marsh and more common on the high marsh. And this also, and he speculated that this was due, I should have gone back a slide, oops. And he speculated that this was due to the fact that up on the high marsh, you get this copious accumulation of detritus, or as he loved to call it, thatch, and you get bonus points if you know the name of this, of what he called this when he was actually out on the marsh, but don't say it out loud. Anyway. He speculated that the accumulation of this thatchy layer was actually very attractive to the to predators, to the spiders in particular. And so you had two confounding variables. Plant hoppers were less common on the high marsh, but this is also where the predators tended to be most common. So it was both plant quality and natural enemies is kind of how the story started forming. But it was really, this is actually, by the way, a great paper. And Jim, thank you so much for pointing out, I think, Bob's lucid writing style. I reread this paper just before coming to this meeting, and I think it epitomizes just how easy it is to understand his ideas if you read this. And Bob, along with Merrill, kind of summarized some of these ideas relating the bottom-up effects with and interfacing them with top-down effects with natural enemies as they affect Delphacid plant hoppers. And there was a period of time when Bob would go to meetings and he would come to the podium and he would start with this feigned exasperation. He would say, "Finally, we have moved beyond the debate of whether top-down or bottom-up effects are most dominant in plant communities." And maybe it wasn't a feigned exasperation. And we have moved now to a time when instead of asking whether it's natural enemies or plant quality, to a time when we're asking when and where are these different factors most significant on the dynamics of herbivores that are sandwiched between them. So armed with this knowledge, actually, let me go back a slide. Armed with this knowledge, no cheaters here. We decided to try to disentangle the effects of whether top-down and bottom-up effects were most dominant on the plant hoppers because of these confounding variables. So we decided to do a very simple experiment, and you've heard several flavors of this as we through the talks today, and that is we just did a fertilization experiment, and we hypothesized that if, in fact, plant hoppers were seeking nitrogen and they were nitrogen-limited up on the high marsh, that we could just apply nitrogen to the high marsh, and we could create a nutrient-rich, high-quality plant similar to that of which you would find on the low marsh. And what we should find is that plant hoppers would colonize this much more than they would colonize the short form Spartina that's normally present on the high marsh. And as a consequence, they would lay a lot of babies and we would get a lot of nymphs at the end of the season. At least this was our hypothesis. So that's what we did. We went out. Oh, okay, so here's the other pens up digression. B. Oh yes, everybody knows that Bob was deathly afraid of snakes. Anyway, so that's exactly what we did. But when we actually went out to the marsh and we did this experiment, we saw more plant hoppers colonize these high biomass, high quality plants. But at the end of the season, we actually saw fewer plant hoppers on these fertilized plants compared to the unfertilized plants. We started scratching our heads, going, what in the world is going on here? Well, What actually was going on was we were collecting a lot of other data, and I'm going to summarize it here in pictures rather than showing you the data. What we found was that early in the season, in response to this early fertilization effect, as the plants were growing, the plants were accumulating biomass, they were sloughing off leaves, creating the thatchy layer. We had an accumulation of algae, of detritivores, flies, columbella that were probably feeding on, microbes and fungi that were decomposing this thatch. We found other herbivores, myriads here, colonizing early. And as a consequence, or perhaps in addition to, we had colonization of these habitats by spiders that were common already in these high marsh areas, in the high marsh areas. When the herbivores colonized late, this now resident and abundant natural enemy community slowly picked them off. This is an hypothesis, and therefore we had fewer herbivores at the end of the season on the high quality plants. So I can't do a talk about with Bob as a co-author without showing food webs here, but I think what we were starting to envision as an hypothesis for the interactions that were taking place on the marsh now was not one where we just had plants and we just had predators and we just had herbivores, but now where we had other components that might also be playing important roles, including the role of alternate prey, the detritivores, the other herbivores. Of course, you've heard today already about the role that habitat structure and plant complexity plays. And then, of course, we started looking at the interactions between these other predators that are also up there. And this was the very nice work that Debbie and Gail were doing at the time. So Bob and I and Danny tried to summarize some of this in a review that came out in 2005. And unfortunately, it's not often read because it appears in a journal I guess nobody reads. But I think it actually... good point. This is kind of the way we envisioned some of the factors, the important forces that were playing out on the marsh. If you look at plant quality, the low marsh, as I said, because of that tidal inundation and the influx of nutrients that were coming from those creek sides, tended to be higher in plant quality than the high marsh. And I didn't talk about this dynamic, but this is just something you see as plants grow over the season. The differences between them actually diminish. The plants are growing in both habitats, and you get a dilution of this nitrogen effect. If you look at the natural enemies, on the other hand, natural enemies tend to already start higher on the high marsh. Those habitats are not scoured and destroyed. You have that thatch already present, and compared to the low marsh, but both areas are going to have increases in the populations. And really, it's the net effect or the net balance between these two factors that govern the dynamics of the plant hoppers on the marsh, where in the low marsh, natural enemies really never accumulate enough to really suppress the populations, and you have outbreaks. Whereas on the high marsh, you actually do get this the natural enemies becoming common enough, and you do get population suppression. So what I think we were doing in the previous experiment was we were taking low-quality plants, and we were boosting them up and making them high-quality, but at the same time, we were doing this in an area where natural enemies were also very abundant, and they were able to numerically aggregate into these habitats that now we had made very thatchy, very complex structured, and we had provided these other natural enemy, the alternative prey sources. And so even though we bumped up plant quality, we still had this population suppression at the end of the season. So we could have left it at that, but what happened is we came back 1 year later, and in some ways I should have given this talk just before Shannon's, but we came back 1 year later to the same plots where we had done these experiments, and these actually were these convenient little islets that we could do these studies on. And this actually is 1 year later what the plants look like in a previously fertilized little plot compared to an unfertilized one here in the background. And mind you, this isn't a place where at these latitudes the Spartina completely dies back every year and has to regrow from rhizome. So this is completely new growth. And in fact, you can see all of this dead accumulated plant biomass from the previous year's growth. And we said, huh, this looks pretty interesting. I wonder what's happening to the other components of the food web. So the plant biomass here, I've summarized this. This is the mean of the fertilized plots compared to the control plots in percent nitrogen and the biomass over time. And in fact, we went back to the same plots for 4 years after that initial fertilization that we did. This is that same year where I showed that first data, and then we continued this out. And you can see this effect kind of slowly decaying over time. The herbivores, on the other hand, at the in the very first season where we did this experiment, recall that the adults colonized the fertilized plots. The nymphs were lower on the other plots, but then you get this kind of persistent and continuous effect on the herbivores in the subsequent years. The spiders, on the other hand, decline, although the web builders seem to hang on. So we had this one-time fertilization that actually affected different parts of the food web in different ways. The plants had a persistent effect that decayed over time, and the herbivores and the predators were responding in somewhat different ways. And this was in the back of my mind when I started at the University of Wisconsin. The thing I want to say here is that Bob's work was really looking at spatial variation in top-down and bottom-up effects, but now we had added at least two dimensions in temporal variation within a season, that previous slide that I showed, and now variation among seasons as well. So I think these were fairly novel contributions that Bob made that really weren't as common in the literature. Oh, yes, this is my favorite. This one's a tough one. Absolutely. Everyone knows that Bob loves spicy food, and this is, I always got a request for this when I was invited for dinner. So these ideas were in the back of my mind when I stumbled upon this project. This is a, how I actually got into this project, I think, is a story all on its own, and I'm not going to have a chance to really go into this. But it has to do with midge emergences from a lake in northern Iceland, where we now do our field work. And these midge abundances are just astronomical, and I'll show you some pictures in a second. The midge populations fluctuate over time, and from kind of trough to peak here can go through over five orders of magnitude increases. And so I was thinking in my mind about the effects, the kind of temporal effects of a resource pulse, and we had done it as a fertilization effect. But now here's an example of a biological resource pulse. And this is what the midges look like in kind of a good year or a bad year. And this is not kind of a mocked up photo. You know, this is really, there are a lot of midges that come out of this lake. This was taken in May of this year. And here's my postdoc, David, and I'm basically obscured by the midges. So we're looking at this, at a model of our food web, and we said, well, the midges are kind of like that fertilization effect that we were presenting in our system, where we can simplify it, and we can say, well, the midges act as an input into the system, and just to simplify it here, instead of looking at the herbivores, we can say, what effect do they have on the detritivores and on the predators? Now, the interesting part, I think I missed a little step there. Let me simplify this a little bit. I know I'm running out of time. Let's look at the dynamics. These are just models now. I don't have data to show you. Let's look at the dynamics of what the detritus predator herbivore interaction looks like. And this is just kind of simple Lacca-Volterra. You have detritivores that grow, but then they get fed upon by the spiders. And eventually, if you wait enough time, the spiders actually make this population go extinct. This is just based on the parameters that we chose in this model. On the other hand, if you add midges, and now these midges are interesting because they can act both as a resource to the detritivores, but also as a resource to the predators. If you add them in this fashion here, what you actually find is as the midges are present, this kind of resource pulse here, the detritivores become very abundant, but so do the spiders, which now can feed on both the midges and the detritivores. But as soon as the midges disappear, the spiders now are super abundant, and they basically wipe out the detritivores in this system. Now, this envisions that the midges become immediately available to the detritivores, and they immediately disappear out of the system after their flights are over. Now, this, I think, adds a little more realism and actually might capture some of the things that we were seeing on the marsh as well. The midges also, as they die, they enter the detrital food web and slowly decompose over time. When you do this, and you add this kind of slow decay of midges, which now can only be used by the detritivores and not by the predators, which only feed on the live midges, what you actually see is that the detritivores could actually persist and maintain themselves over time, whereas the spiders, which can rely mostly on the midges and a little bit on the detritivores, actually decrease over time. So to summarize, what I think this model shows and what I think Bob really inspired was that if you start looking at these indirect and more complex effects of time on food webs, you get some dynamics that you might not predict automatically. And I would argue that this kind of storage effect that we were seeing with the plant quality in the Spartina system, and that we might be seeing with this detrital storage effect in our Icelandic system, might be actually a common phenomenon that occurs in a lot of places where you get inputs of resources, of pulsed inputs of resources. So I just want to thank everyone again, and I want to thank Bob for even just getting me thinking about these things. So thanks a lot.